I'm Peter Marshall. I'm the Professor of Imperial History at King's College London and was appointed to the working group when John Roberts resigned, and that was in July 1989.
Can you tell me, Professor Marshall, how it was you were invited to join the history working group in 1989?
I'm not, of course, privy to all the discussions that may have gone on about this. My guess would be something like this, that some names of... They want another academic historian, because John Roberts was their academic historian. They had probably been given a list of people by the kinds of professional bodies. In my case, I would think the Royal Historical Society, which I was much involved in, and by the Historical Association, whatever. I'm very clear from the questioning of Roger Hennessy, which was very perfunctory, and there's no reason why it should not have been, about whether I would join, that they wanted somebody who they thought was sort of middle of the road. They were very keen not to have somebody very committed, for instance, to schools history project work and things of that sort. But also, they were very clear that they didn't want Professor Skidelsky or somebody of that disposition, because Roger sort of said, what did I think, I do remember this in my interview, what did I think about the arguments about skills and content? And I said I thought it was a pretty artificial argument, and he stopped me at that point. He said, say no more, that's exactly what I want to hear, but it's exactly what I expected to hear. So I think that's why it was. But I imagine they would have had another of names, and for some reason, which probably pretty random, they chose me. I'm sure they had no previous knowledge of me because I had no previous involvement in this kind of thing, which may well have been a virtue from their point of view.
So what was the specialist perspective that you were expected to bring to the group?
Well, I suppose what any academic historian is supposed to do, which is to just, to, in a way, vet the quality of the history, assume that what they wanted to do was regarded by academic historians as good, sound history. And I think clearly they had in view something which they had reason to worry about, that academic historians were going to give trouble, and it was important to have at least one academic historian, but actually they had two. Alice Prohaska had strong academic credentials. But, of course, it didn't save off trouble at all. But my guess is that that's what an academic historian was about, was to give a sort of safety catch view that this wasn't outrageous and would not send academic historians into hysterics. My guess is that John Roberts had played a strong role in it, because a great deal of what was there, the outlines of, obviously the questions that would relate always to us, I think, would be the questions of content, of what periods, what subjects. Neither of us, I'm sure, could claim any expertise on levelling or other arcane matters. But John Roberts, I think, had taken a strong line. I actually didn't, it's not in my nature. I, in general, was supportive of what they wanted to do, but in the end made quite a lot of suggestions about topics and programmes of study and how they might be presented, things of that sort. But really, that was my concern, I think. I kept out of debates about primary education because I had absolutely no experience on it. Actually, no experience of secondary education either, but that's another story. But in general, it was to, I think, that was with the view of what they wanted from an academic historian. It has to be said, I think, that one of Michael's, Saunders Watson's strengths as a chairman is that he would not let anybody contract out of anything. We all had to own, that was his phrase, and that's everybody's phrase, what had been done. And so I would sit through, without comprehending much, wonderful, the arcane discussions of levelling with Tim Lomas. But he would not let anybody not appear to have understood what was going on. That was not always easy from my point of view, or to sort of nurture a sense of hostility to it, which would then come out later. We had to agree things. And this may not be relevant, but it could be, from my point of view, slightly frustrating in that I would carefully design programs of study, much too carefully, and then it was submitted to the whole company, who would pull them to pieces and put in all sorts of terrible cliches and things like that. I had said, no, we don't believe things like that anymore, we never have. But I think that was a wise policy, and he was, I have to say, he was a good chairman. and made certain that everybody was involved in everything. But I take it that my function was much more in the kind of history that was going to be included than in the certainly the technical areas of levelling or even the refinements of the attainment targets and things of that sort.
Mm. So, did you have any involvement at all in the school system or in education below university?
No, not really. I don't even have children. So, that point of view, completely neutral. I mean, I'm sure that this hasn't reached them, but I am passionately concerned about history as a subject at every level of our society. And I did a lot of visiting secondary schools and things like that sort. And I had, as everybody in those days, particularly the early part of my career, had trained a lot of history graduates who then went into school teaching. Shortly afterwards, they, of course, all went in the city. But that's something else. So, but beyond that, no, I have no expertise.
You had visited secondary school?
Oh, yes. Because you go and try to recruit and try to interest people to go to universities. I'd done a tour, for instance, of the Isle of Wight for the Historical Association to try to encourage people in the sixth forms there to do history. They always ask me the same question. If we do history at university, does that mean we leave the Isle of Wight? And I said, yes, it does. Oh, good.
Well, it's an obvious group.
So I've done things like that. I mean, and I've been fairly active in the Historical Association. And in those days, it reached sixth forms much more than it does now. And I talked to sixth forms a lot. And I've never refused an invitation to go to a school. But that doesn't amount to much.
So what were the issues facing the History Working Group when you joined?
Well, of course, this was the aftermath of the interim report and the reservations which Kenneth Baker had expressed at the very end of his time, which we now know, I think, were the Prime Minister's, and John McGregor had to take up. And in a way, I think it would be too strong to say that the group was in a sense of shock. I think they were very committed to the interim report, and some of the things could easily be adjusted. I mean, the question of the balance between British and other sorts of history, things like that. The real one that went right through is knowledge and the attainment targets, and that was from the outset the major issue. And it's one which I think we were unanimous, and that would include the professional advisors, which is Roger, that we would do what we could to meet the Secretary of State's problems about this, but actually to have a set body of knowledge as an attainment target that had to be learned regardless of the context that it was in, we couldn't do that. And so I think, I mean, this may be getting on to some of your later questions, I think that very much shaped our discussion, and very much shaped what I think is the weakness of our work, that our alternative was to make the programmes of study very knowledge heavy. And I think that's a mistake, because it's not practical. I mean, they're marvellous documents often, these programmes of study, and since I drafted initially most of the later ones, I feel perfectly happy to say that. But they're not realistic, and teachers confronted them would have been, I think, facing, in most cases, very, very serious problems. But it was this attempt to try to get round knowledge and the attainment target that really occupied so much time, and these fanciful conceits of the cone showing and very sweetly the DES or somebody gave me a little paperweight with the cone on it. But that really was the thing that knowledge, I think I've sensed that the group was very united by the time I get there, and that's partly a tribute again to Michael's chairmanship. Partly perhaps the fact that we were all sort of middle of the roaders, but we were not prepared to go down that route. And I felt very strongly myself about this, that it would be a way to official history. And that I'm sure was not what ministers wanted, because they had what I think is the great strength of our system and a great problem in so many other countries, that we couldn't prescribe books, and Roger was always keen to say that we were producing a curriculum, not a syllabus. It was then for the teachers to find the books and the material out of which they would deliver it. There would not be an official textbook with an official version. But I think a knowledge attainment target would have come quite close to that.
So publishers would obviously have produced the books. based on?
I mean, so it's a very interesting way. I mean, it's a free market economy in a way, isn't it? I mean, the publishers were showing a lot of interest in what we were doing, and they were very keen to see what the final version would be, because then perhaps, it's up to them, unless the teachers were prepared to do their own programmes of study. And I had some rather interesting experiences with a group of North London teachers who were trying to do a sort of a Partition of Africa programme of study. And I think to do a program study in the way that we laid down was going to be very, very difficult and very hard work. Mm-hmm. And I think even to do the programs of study that we laid down was going to be very difficult and very hard work. I mean, all that thing that they were so proud of, the PESC formula, politics, economics, society, culture, it's pretty unreal, really, when you think about it. But that really was the issue over and over again. I remember producing what I'm told was not absolutely ineffective, producing for the Secretary of State, who was then McGregor, I think, a little sort of hypothesis that if we had knowledge and attainment targets on a unit on the Reformation, why are you prepared to lay down the body of knowledge in Protestant schools it had all been a disaster, and people were naturally Catholic, and this was a result of Henry VIII's wicked business state's point of view? Or was he prepared to lay down as a body of knowledge for Catholic schools that the old church was hopelessly corrupt and the Reformation was not needed? And the civil servant sent back, I can't remember which one it was, eventually sent back a message saying, Secretary of State, seize your point.
When you were preparing the programmes of study, were you aware this is overambitious?
I'm not sure. In a way, of course, this problem was there. I mean, the programmes of study in the interim report are overambitious. Yes, I think I was. I kept on thinking, what can you expect? What can people be expected to do? What have people got? My way of going about this, I mustn't claim too much credit or discredit for them, but a lot of the, particularly when we were sort of expanding into non-European things, which I'm very keen on, I would try and do an outline, and then I would actually talk to academic people in the University of London, which are very useful, and say, does this look okay for the Imperial China or something? It has to be said that the people with teaching experience would then say, come on, Peter, this is not really realistic, and we would cut them down in the meetings. But I think when we really got the bit between our teeth a bit in a way, and so it went.
Well, one wonders if it's, you know, enthusiasm, really.
Yes.
People have their things that they're interested in,
yes.
And they feel children should know about.
Yes, there's that. And that, I mean, I think, if this is not derailing your line of questioning, I think that's an important element of the working group, is its enthusiasm for the subject. And as a result, we were in a way a bit competitive, and we were over ambitious, but we did it for the subject. I think our sense was that we were actually lucky to get it in. We didn't get it in, that Kenneth Baker had this strong commitment as a foundation subject. There was then something which you may know about, and looking at my scrapbooks, it reminds me, but I've forgotten how lively the sense was, that at the end, when eventually the HA, the Historical Association, got the teachers in line, more or less behind it, it was because there was a threat that it would not be a foundation subject if we really couldn't make up our mind what we wanted. So there was that strong sense of enthusiasm for the subject, that strong sense that we had to fight for the 3 or 4 hours per week, which is quite unreal, isn't it? Strong sense that history, we were doing history as a separate discipline, that we were dismantling the humanities and other sorts of things that people were doing, and that was right. And I remember, for instance, my niece as a primary school teacher, and she said, look, we can't do this, I don't do it. And she gave me an example of what she did, which is fine. She said, I do pick things like water, and we look at the history of, certainly, of canals and things like that, but we also look at the chemistry, the natural environment, things like that. That's what we do. Sorry, that's not what you're going to do in the future. So I think you do need to bear that in mind, that this tremendous sense of this is history's chance, and we've got to make a maximum claim for history, and we've got to show it in its most impressive light. And I think, I don't know whether you would agree, I think that some of the bits that are in there, most of them, the interim group did, I do claim a little credit for some of it, are defences of why history is important as a national consideration in schools and everything else. I think that's marvellous, and I don't think it's changed much. I mean, reading the material afterwards, and I think we did that very well. But we were in a sense a bit competitive. The working groups worked not coordinatedly, of course not. They worked in competition, starting out to one another, and we were going to, steal the thunder from geography a bit and take for granted. So I think if I were a history teacher at that time, and I think I got that sense, I would feel a certain sense of gratitude, I suppose, ultimately for Baker that he wanted it in, and perhaps a little for us that we made so strong a case for it. But I would also feel very irritated with us that we made it so very difficult for teachers to do what we were asking them to do. And we would say, I mean, I would go to a lot of teachers' meetings, and I'd say, well, look, we do have your best interests at heart. We actually don't want to pressure or over-regulate you, but this is our chance, this is your chance. Do you want it not to be in the national curriculum? Well, they didn't answer very clearly to that, and why should they? It's an unfair question.
So how did the civil servants from the DES and Roger Hennessy, the inspector, work with them?
Well, at that point, I think that the group was very collegial. Roger was obviously a leading figure, and he would direct, again, from my point of view, the technicalities. But by then he had sort of, I think he'd gone native, he'd merged into the group, or we'd gone to him or in the past, but there was very little sense of us against him ever, I don't think. He was an accommodating, nice man, and again, very much a middle of the roader, as we all were. And it wasn't, I didn't sense a difficult relationship. It may have been more difficult earlier, because he obviously had to establish this is what we are doing, and so you don't have much freedom on that. But he was strongly on our side over this knowledge issue, and we didn't have difficulties with him. Senior civil servant Jenny Baker, I never met, I don't think. I think she'd been quite a presence before. Barney Baker, of whom I spoke in slightly irreverently but off the record, came, but it didn't make a difference. And Jenny Westfield, who was there, was the secretary. I mean, she. So there's a sense in which I don't think it was an us against them. I think Roger was part of the group, and he was a bit embattled because, of course, he was getting a lot of stick. I mean, at many of the meetings, his predecessor, Mr. Slater, was obviously a fine, impressive man, turned up, but he didn't feel, I think, among his obligations was being loyal to his successor. And Roger was being very much criticised for being a government lackey and pushing through over-regulated systems and things like that. So we, in a way, hung together, I think.
So it's not the case that the civil servants arrived with material and said, this is...
Well, they may well have done in the early stages, have said, well, this is the number of things you've got, and things like that. I would think they did, but they certainly didn't arrive with any academic material. Roger had bits of views about academia, but not. I mean, he wouldn't try to overrule us on. He would say, the teacher's going to find this very difficult, or I think there are going to be problems about this, but he would never say... until the Secretary of State said, well, we've got to have 50% British, and so he said, okay, we've got to have 50% British, but he would never say, no, that's subversive, or that's not what we should be doing, or something like that. I didn't pick that up at all.
That's interesting. Why do you think that the communication with the politicians wasn't as good as, say, with the civil servants?
It's an interesting question. I suppose the politicians have other things to do. I mean, I think that in a way, it raises it to my mind, this is something I kept on thinking about, very interesting questions about the limits of politics. I mean, my guess is that in a perfect model of the national curriculum, there were political decisions and there were educational decisions. And the setting up of a working group was a sign, in a way, the politicians wanted the educational business to be at arm's length. They would lay down what subjects would be in the curriculum. They would lay down the various things required by the various acts. But I think their initial intention was to leave us to our own devices. But I think they found with history that they couldn't resist getting involved. And so on the one hand, it was a strength that they weren't always leaning over our shoulders, as far as I know, saying, why are you doing this or something like that. But on the other hand, of course, when they actually got things, particularly when they got the interim report, then they discovered they did have views. And you got these things which went on. I mean, it went on in Kenneth Clark and John Major, as you know. I mean, this business of saying we don't do history after 1963, and all that sort of absurdity. In an ideal world, I suppose, we would have said, these are our educational decisions. If you don't like them, you find another working group. But we didn't do that, and maybe we should have done. But I think in a way, the distance of the politicians was initially an advantage. And from that point of view, it was what they ought to have been doing. But they couldn't resist having a view. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what happened. The most contentious thing the interim group did, interim report did, I think, was to say that we don't do the Second World War anymore. We do post-war developments, and I could see that I think was a John Roberts decision, and I can see why it made a lot of sense, which is that we are, as Germans and other people say, obsessed with the Second World War, and we should grow up a bit. But that wasn't going to go because there was a huge popular reaction. The teachers didn't like it because they got all this material on it. The Jewish lobby very understandably said, you're pretending the Holocaust didn't happen. They did say that. The British Legion didn't like it. And clearly, I think ministers did, because you probably pick up from your cuttings and things. Andrew Rumbold announced that it wasn't the Second World War was going to be bad before. I think we'd actually formally decided that it would, which I think that was the most interventionist thing. And thereafter, well, we knew that we were going into difficulties at the end, because Mrs. T did have strong views and she didn't like it. John McGregor, I think, clearly acted as a kind of middle ground. I mean, I think in the end he was convinced that we'd done the best we could about knowledge, and he kept her at bay. But you remember her solution, or the solution that he went, which she liked, was that it should go back to discussion, and hence the long delay. And at that point, I think the schools did rally to it, because they thought an awful lot was at stake. The Gulf War began, Mrs. T had better things to do, and then she left office. And so we basically got away with it. But right to the end, we were uncertain as to whether she was going to veto it, because McGregor invited us to dinner, I think, at the end. And just before that, the Times had carried a thing, obviously, what was that chap called, who was our press secretary, Bernard Ingham, had briefed the Times saying how much Mrs. Thatcher still disliked it. But John McGregor said very admonitively, don't worry, we're going to put it out to consultation, it'll all be all right. And it more or less was. Although, of course, Major and Kenneth Clark couldn't resist having goes later on. So, I don't know, I think very high ideals that the content would be non-political, and no doubt in huge numbers of elements of the national curriculum that is so, that people tend not to have a political view about science. But in history and English literature, but above all history, they found that they did have views, and they were under pressure. I mean, I'm sure the Jewish lobby perfectly rightly worried about this, and I'm sure Mrs. Thatcher, with her Jewish voters, and she knew about that, and why should they not? I mean, it's perfectly legitimate. And so, if you thought about it, it was perhaps a bit naive to suppose that you could have this political educational divide, and it didn't work out. On the other hand, it was not all loss, I think, because I think the high profile that history got in all this was ultimately good for history. I hope it was.
And perhaps showing the importance of it in people's attitudes to education.
Yes. or people's attitudes to national identity and to life or whatever. I mean, it, if it was ever a serious discussion that it should go out of the national tradition, I have no idea whether it was. I mean, that's the kind of thing which, it's sad if the archives won't tell you that. Or whether it was just done to scare the teachers. But, I mean, in a way, I think it wasn't all loss. It was at the time pretty scary and difficult. But because you always felt you were being assailed on two sides, on the side by the great body of teachers who were saying, you're government stooges, you're laying down these impossible regulations on us. And when you knew that far from that being the case, the Prime Minister, with her tremendous energy, was obviously reading everything. There's supposed to be a famous story, have you heard this one, that the great professor of education at Exeter, Ted Bragg, wasn't it, that when she went to Exeter, she shot him out of a tree with him in a shower of rain, and she turned on him and said, "Professor Bragg, I cannot tell you how much I dislike this history syllabus." You've not heard that story?
No.
Well, it may not be true, but it was certainly relayed to us. I wouldn't have thought he was her sort of man, but on the other hand, she probably didn't know that.
No. Were there submissions from members of the public discussed by the group?
Well, it's difficult to deal with because there were so many. And I think, in a way, they came late. The DS hauled them up. But you couldn't be ignorant of public debate. And I always felt that you had to listen to teachers. And as I would go to teachers' meetings all over the place and sit and listen. And I remember saying to Keith Robbins, the president of the HA, who organised most of the things, who'd be an interesting man to talk to, nobody's called me a fascist racist yet. And he said, "Oh, don't worry, you've got half an hour to go." But I would go to that and listen and try to say, "Look, yes, we hear what you say, but this is what we've got to do." And it didn't become much high spirit. Except when I went to the independent schools, who, of course, were supremely self-competent about it. I started the usual defensive spiel to them, and they said, "Come off it. This is all right. We'll use it if we want to. We won't use it if we don't want to. It doesn't matter." And what they chiefly wanted to do at that meeting was to bully the A-level examiners. And I really wished there was that degree of self-confidence in the state sector, because if the teachers wouldn't do it, it won't get done. That's it. They could easily have said, "Well, we'll take the bits we like and ignore the bits we don't like." Particularly, of course, they didn't know the testing system was going to be demolished. And so, but they were, I would go to as many meetings as I could, and I went to former students. I'd say, "Can I come and see you teach?" And which are things I should have done ages ago. But you didn't get a lot of time to do that. I mean, one of the theories of the working group was that we would go around the country. We would have meetings. I remember with the Angela Rumbel business, was in Great Yarmouth, meetings in all over the place. We'd stay in Trust House Fort hotels, and if I ever eat another Trust House Fort hotel, breakfast. And we would then visit the local schools. But we never had time to do that. We would actually sit in the conference rooms at these awful hotels, solidly until about midnight, and we never got out to talk to the schools because there was never any time, and we were endlessly devising means of implementing the levelling or criticising the programmes of study or refining the attainment targets. It was very hard-pounding.
You said you actually constructed many of the programmes.
Yes.
Did you find it difficult then to have it scrutinised by everybody?
Oh, well, yes. As I said earlier, I mean, it could be very frustrating if all sorts of hoary on this were reinstated and things like that. But no, you had to learn to do that. And eventually you had little ways. You could say to Michael, "I'm sorry, but that, I do promise you that won't go." But he didn't like that too much. I mean, he would insist that, no, you had to do that. That was life. It could be frustrating. I remember Alice and I would sometimes have long sessions of complaining, but to one another. But it's just as if I had expressed strong views on levelling, which I never did. They could have said, "Stop it! It's nothing to do with you."
Did the press interest in the history of national curriculum affect the group's work?
I doubt it. I think The civil servants did keep quite tight discipline. I think there had been some talking to the press earlier in the term of the interim group. I never talked to the press. I think the press never focused on who I was. And indeed, I think nobody focused on who I was, which is very lucky. But in the end, I mean, I was occasionally rung up, and I would always say, I'm sorry, I can't help you there. You'll have to talk to the department. So I doubt whether it did. I occasionally would, and you'll see them in the chat, would occasionally write letters, but always with the encouragement of Roger or Michael. I mean, my sort of job was to try to keep academics in line, which I'm very unsuccessful at. But I would write letters saying, look, what you say is not based on any real understanding. Look again, or something like that. I mean, one felt a bit under siege because the press was so volatile, and it was, I sent you an email, that this poor little British Empire thing, which said you should study internationalism, was assumed to be, somebody called Judith Judd in The Observer wrote some article saying this was Thatcher showing, imposing her will on us. Well, exactly the opposite. She had strong views about the British Empire because she had told the Commonwealth Prime Ministers how lucky they were to be ruled by Britain. Do you remember that famous occasion? And I'm sure she thought we were much too lukewarm. I can't document that, but I'm sure she did. But I think it was a sort of all part of the part of the storm and whatever was whirling around our heads. But I doubt whether it did. On the whole, I mean, the professional education correspondents were on the whole helpful and constructive, I think. I mean, again, you've looked at it, but not a lot to complain in that. But it all made it more melodramatic. But the civil servants were very keen to stop. I think it had started, but before my time, to stop any unauthorised talking. And in fact, the press wanted to know about this is, again, in a way, extraordinarily interesting. I'm sure they didn't want to know about a lot of the other programmes to study.
What was your view about the issue of testing historical knowledge? Because at that time, you thought there were going to be tests.
Well, I think this is what we've been trying to say, that I think our solution was that it must be tested in the context of the programmes of studies that we're putting forward. But that to have set bits of knowledge, and we go into some detail about what knowledge might mean, that assumed that every student knew the date of the Battle of Agincourt and the date of the Battle of Waterloo and things like that, which I've got a feeling some ministers thought ought to be what we were doing, that first of all was privileging certain bits of knowledge, taking them out of context, but that I think we all felt, I actually have a lot of sympathy, as far as I understand it, for the thing that a lot of academics were making, sort of bogey empathy. I have a lot of sympathy about that, but I think empathy without knowing the, trying to understand what people thought about particular things seems to be wholly admirable. But empathy without the context of knowing what a sort of person could reasonably be expected to have felt, because you know the context in which he or she operated, then that is open to all sorts of wild abuses. I had a story that one of my pupils told me that he'd been doing something on the Black Death, and he'd asked the pupils to write what it might have been like during the Black Death, and he got a wonderful submission, which I still remember, which is from a female pupil saying, I woke up in the morning, I didn't feel very well, I didn't want my Weetabix, so I phoned my friend Mandy, telling her to go in and tell teacher that I probably got a touch of the Black Death. if you, those sort of stories are infinitely damaging, but I'm sure that they are unusual. And so I think we felt all the time that we wanted people to know a lot, and the more they knew, the better. But to have a privileged bit of knowledge that everybody should know. You and I all have views of what we would like people to know, and I think the kinds of things that used to worry Mrs. Thatcher, there was some episode outside the Imperial War Museum on television where lights were shone in the faces of children, and they were asked to say what the date for the First and Second World War, and they failed. Well, that's not very edifying, it's a pity, but I don't think the answer to that is to learn by heart the date for the First and Second World War.
It's no And what were the contentious areas over content?
Try and think. I mean, I thought about this. I don't recall a lot. I think we had some views, and I'm trying to reconstruct them, that we would avoid things which were very obviously contentious. And I'm not quite sure why we thought that. But one of the things that eventually we did put in something about African people in the Americas, but up to that point, the working group, that is an initiative which I took, but I took it prompted by other people as well. The working group wished to avoid that, and I'm trying to think why, because of course the slave trade comes into Key Stage 3, I mean, no doubt of that. But their sort of feeling, I think, was that it would produce very simple-minded answers or work. The same thing, we felt that we didn't want to do the Crusades, although the teachers immediately reinstated it. We wanted to try to understand Islamic, to have a unit on Islamic culture and civilization. So there were those sorts of issues, but they were not terribly difficult ones. In the end, Michael yielded when I said, I think there is a strong body of opinion about this, and I think we would be open to serious misrepresentation if we appeared not to have done it. But I don't recall shouting matches or whatever. I think they were over by then. I mean, I'm not sure that many people would then felt that since on the great issues of more British history, that they really wanted to go to the last ditch about that. But they certainly did about knowledge. Maybe my memory is it all looks more harmonious than it was, but it was relatively harmonious.
So there weren't many disagreements at all?
That would be my view. It would be interesting to see what other views you get, but that I think would be my view. Or they weren't fundamental ones. I mean, we could get cross with one another over things which, suggestions which seem preposterous and things of that sort, but it wasn't too bad.
So looking back from 2009, what comments would you make on the way in which the first national curriculum was conceived and produced?
Well, I think it was, the things that I've tried to say, I think we were over-ambitious for reasons which I've tried to suggest were not, we want to do the best for the subject. I think we made a very, very strong case for the subject. I'm now not sure about whether the dismantling of all these programs which merge history in other things are quite deserved the condemnation that we did. That I think we should, I think to assume 3 or 4 hours, but that's what we were told to do. Well, the teachers very quickly said, look, that's not what real life is like. And therefore, as a result, partly because we were trying to push all this knowledge into the attainment targets in order to make it clear that we were in favour of knowledge, we produced very seriously over elaborate programmes of study. So a lot of that was wasted effort, I think, because the teachers weren't going to do it anyway, even if they survived with official imprimaturs.
So do you think that over time it's been dismantled to a certain extent?
Well, I was looking at what the websites were doing, and the earliest one, the latest one that I could get, which actually seemed to be giving positive guidance, was 1999 for Key Stage 3. And I thought that actually our sense of what should be done had survived pretty well. Continuous British history, I bet you it isn't done, but that is. I mean, that's a noble aspiration. And I don't think anybody should be penitent about that. I mean, it's not done. I didn't even do it as an undergraduate. I didn't do the 15th century, I remember, or I didn't do much in the 18th century, perish the thought, although that's the century I've now spent all my life to study. But I think, that's there as an aspiration. There is one of my academic colleagues wrote quite a relevant thing, which is in the scrapbook, and you've probably seen, saying that Europe is badly treated, and I think Europe is. We couldn't say the continuous history of Europe, I think, I mean, for goodness sake, where would it end? And then you'd say the continuous history of the world. But I think Europe, once we insist, as we did, on the period of the wars, then you say another sort of European turning point. And we suggested, and I think those were mostly there in 1999, the Reformation, the age of Louis XIV, the French Revolution, something like that. That's about the best you can do, but of course, it's not giving you much sense of the European things. I was very keen on the world stuff, and I think I get a slight sense, but maybe I'm getting it wrong, and maybe you could even tell me, that some of the idealism of that has gone. We kept on saying a culture on its own terms. Well, parents would say, you don't know what its own terms are, you never, but try to envisage what Imperial China was like on its own terms, and not, whereas now, it seems to me, there's a lot of non-European history, but it's a bit instrumental. It's a bit, this is the place where people come from, who come to Britain, and this is the contribution they made to Britain, and things like that. And I'm all in favour of that, but I think that sort of idealism that children should be really stretched may exist most in studying the ancient civilizations. And I noticed that the Key Stage 2 in the 1999 guidance, it was ancient civilizations, and there's a lot to be said for that. But the sort of sense of wonder which one hoped people would get from looking at China, looking at India, not simply as a piece of the Raj, but as a cultural civilization, maybe that's gone a bit. Well, again, you haven't got much time, and it's very taxing for teachers, unless it happens to be their interest.
I think over time, certain topics have become popular. So yes. the resources have been produced for yes. them, and everyone's adopted those because that's what's available.
Yes. One thing that I did design, and I saw it was in the 1999 Key Stage thing, was India Moguls to Early British. And I think there are some good material done on that. But it does come back to your very important point, I suppose, which is, in a sort of free market economy, if you don't prescribe the books, and you couldn't, well, I would be so open to abuse. And I think the ministers were petrified that they would get in the hands of raving Marxists and things like that if they did. If you don't prescribe the books, then it's left to commercial decisions, isn't it? And so minority programs of study are not going to be done, I don't think. And probably some of the things have probably never been done. I think it's very likely.
I remember he was talking to me about the cultural politics surrounding the work of the History Working Group. Yes. Is there something that you could say more about?
Well, I think the things did, of course, get politicised, and some of the things which are in my scrapbook, and you've probably seen, for instance, a very interesting essay that Raphael Samuel wrote, yes. saying that the left is missing out on this. The left, on the whole, thought we were okay, and Raphael Samuel was very supportive. And there's a thing which you may have seen, if not, it's in there, by Christopher Hill saying, stick by the working group. The left probably thought we were wishy-washy liberals, but at least they did their sense that they wanted a fundamental rethinking. If they wanted it, it didn't come out. Whereas the right did have these views, and I think they have points of view which are perfectly legitimate. They wanted it to be a sort of supporting of civic values, which obviously from their point of view are rather conservative values. Kenneth Baker's instructions are interesting. I mean, Kenneth Baker was an old-fashioned Whig, as many people have said, and that how we must show how Britain has become a flourishing democracy and things like that. Which on the whole is going beyond his brief, I think, but on the whole, people like Raphael Samuels thought that was harmless, whereas the right, I think, wanted a celebration of Britain's, up to a point, military and imperial past. I mean, I don't want to over-demonize them. For instance, someone like Robert Skidelsky, I don't think you could say that of him. I don't know him. I think he had got involved very much with the Lewis case, with the Chris McGovern and the other chap whose name I've forgotten. And he thought they'd been very badly treated. And Roger Hennessy said, yes, they have. We were very silly. We should have let them do that Scottish thing. That's what they wanted. No harm done. So I think he became a great apostle of dates and solid knowledge. Not, I think, with a strong ideological commitment. But some of the others, I mean, there's bits by a man called Jonathan Clark in there, which are obviously very ideologically pushed towards the right. And they are. But more or less, the right had its agenda. The left didn't. Or if it did, it would be not very clearly articulated, I think. And on the whole, more and more, I mean, Eric Hobsbawm said, they're doing no harm, let them go. Alice and I had to go around. I didn't see him. We went around and saw people like Asa Briggs and Alan Bullock and people like that, and to keep them online, because they would be in the House of Lords. Yes, they kept online. Whereas we didn't try with people like Hugh Trevor Roper, who would be on the other, Lord Baker would be on the other side.
Since the national curriculum was devised, it's been progressively simplified, hasn't it?
Yes.
And citizenship and other issues have been introduced. Yes. What is your view about the way that...
Well, I think it had to be simplified. I wouldn't regard that. Citizenship was a little bit comes out on the view is that these are all values that we would admire. But if you make, again, if I'm using the word rightly, if you make history too instrumental, that it is to propagate a set of values, you're treading a dangerous path, I think. Bit which I think I may be able to find, which I like to think that I actually did write about the importance of history for democratic society, and I can't think, well, if Mrs. Thatcher such hated it, because we don't know. Where is it? 1117, I think. History raises moral questions. This is a crucial and highly sensitive issue and appears in two ways. The form of history as advocated in this report, which supports the values of democratic societies, and I'm very happy to say that, open-mindedness, respect for a range of possible interpretation based on evidence, objectivity. These qualities have by no means been universal. They have not always been adopted by historians themselves. They are not immune from challenge. Much of the subject raises explicit moral questions, notably when human motivation and choice are involved, and when the question of the ultimate importance of greater episodes, was it good, was it bad? But it's a sense, I think, of the open-endedness of history, which, I'm sure people do, when they include inclusiveness, are aware of that. But anything that says, well, we all know, don't we, that inclusiveness is good, well, we all do, but we want the young to think it out for themselves. And when we faced multiculturalism, we said, I think, that the kind of scepticism which and questioning which we're instilling will inevitably demolish stereotypes and think, well, it may do, it may not, but we hope it will. So I think I have the utmost sympathy with the sense of the need to instill values of inclusiveness. But I think the report did stress again and again the openness of history, and that that was its great virtue, that it was, I think I felt that in the national curriculum, if you weren't going to do much English literature, this was a case where you were opening people into moral debate, not giving them clear-cut answers, which literature, of course, would also do. Perhaps that's not what happens. It shows how out of touch I am. These sort of inclusiveness and citizenship are not closing down the options. But if the kids want to spout fascist things, I think you have to let them and see what happens. And I'm sure that's easier said than done, because I'm sure if they get the bit between their teeth in certain parts of the country, they can be extremely difficult. Mould pages.
Yes, it may be down to the teachers.
Yes, yes. And I'm still not sure that is the teachers should. I remember I had a lot of dealings with what was then the Polytechnic in North London, and I used to go and talk to their education classes, and there's somebody actually, I can't remember origin, I think Afro-Caribbean, he said, I do mind, I hate the British. It's all right, no, never mind. And when you teach that, given the fact that you must show that that's not the only view, but if you want to open up British people's eyes to the fact that you think their record overseas is utterly deplorable, go ahead, do it. But you mustn't say that that is the only way of looking at it. Well, that's feeble liberalism, but...
The new Key Stage 3 curriculum, of course, does have a focus on the British Empire included in it, under the trade on topic colonisation, industrialisation, technology, including the abolition of slavery, so it's a big topic. As a historian of the Empire, do you think it should be reflected like that in the history curriculum?
I'm glad that it is. I mean, my own feeling about the history of the Empire is that it should be widely taught, because it is very important both in the history of the way Britain's evolved and in the history of many people who come to Britain. And I've been very much involved in the British Empire Commonwealth Museum at Bristol, which has wonderful, I think, or had, alas, it's now gotten to serious financial difficulties and is temporarily closed, programs of education. And so I think I'm all in favour that people should look at it and then make up their minds for themselves. And as I said to you in my email, even in 1990, it was difficult for people not to panic when it was suggested you should study the empire and say you're trying to indoctrinate, so telling us that we should be proud of the empire. We're just trying to get you to think about it. And I think we are a bit better now at treating it as another form of history, which has all sorts of issues. I mean, it meant different things in different ways. It's horrendous in the slave trade or in the people who were dispossessed of land in southern Africa or whatever, putting enormous advantages in the way of people in Hong Kong or Singapore. And there's also a problem that very recently in a discussion of Australian and Canadian history, I was asked why this is never taught in British schools, and I'd say, I'm sorry, but it isn't. Recognising that is a dimension. And I said, well, the problem, I think, is that you've never formed a sort of pressure group, although there's no doubt, this is a stereotype, lots of Australian kids in Earls Court who would benefit from being taught this. But it is the view of empire in a rather narrow, well, not a narrow sense, but the view of empire's rule over other people, which is what most people think. And yes, I think that's got to be looked at. So I'm happy that it's there. And I hope now people don't think that it is impossible to look at it in the way which we prescribe in our old attainment targets, recognising different interpretations or whatever. I mean, on awful occasion at a teacher's meeting where a young male student came up to me and said, I think you're putting in that thing is an insult to my black pupils. And I said, yeah, at all. I mean, have you never read, for instance, the work of Eric Williams and people like that? I mean, black people study the history of the empire, they agree with it. He had obviously never heard of Eric Williams, but this is what the whole sort of cultural climate made him want to say. And that's what he wanted to say, but it's sad.
Well, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
That's all the questions.
Pleasure. Thanks very much.